Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today, our program takes us to Brunswick and Bowdoin College for a talk on climate change by environmental activist and champion of Inuit human rights, Sheila Watt Cloutier. A Canadian Inuit, Watt Cloutier has been a powerful voice in the growing discussion of global climate change, human rights, and political and economic policies within the international arena. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net, a service made possible by member support. Look under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen for Audio On Demand, where you'll find a listing of available programs, including this, and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. Introducing the speaker is John Studzinski, Bowdoin College trustee and a member of the class of 1978.
My name is John Studzinski. I'm Bowdoin, class of 1978, and we have a real treat for you today. We're thrilled to have what I would call the real thing here today. We all, in this environment today, read about activists, and we're very much focused on the issues of the environment. But I think we all have an inherent greater degree of respect and admiration when we meet somebody who not only talks about activism, but whose life is exemplary of a real passion for activism and a passion for the environment. Sheila Watt Cloutier is an environmental activist. She's been a powerful voice on the growing, and now I think what has grown, discussion of global climate change. Human rights, political and economic problems, and this is broadly defined today within the international arena. She's a Canadian Inuit, and she was born in northern Quebec, and she was raised in a traditional Inuit community. She's represented the interests, and this is impressive, of 155,000 Inuits in Russia, Alaska, Canada, and Greenland at the Stockholm Convention, I want to get my notes perfect here, that banned the manufacture and use of persistent organic pollutants that enter the Arctic food chain. In 2005, Sheila and others filed a landmark petition with the International American Commission on Human Rights, alleging that unchecked greenhouse gas emissions violated Inuit cultural environmental rights. Today, as one of our honorary degree recipients this year with our 204th commencement, Sheila will offer us her words entitled "Bringing the Right to be Cold into the U.S. Climate Consciousness." Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sheila Watt Cloutier.
Thank you so much for that introduction and the warmth of this area of the world where I'm just coming in from the Arctic. Actually, I was in Calgary for an event, but I am coming in from the Arctic the last 2 days, and we're still pretty cold up there, which is the way we like it. And we've had a longer spring as well, which is really good for us because we do tend to be out on the ice and snow for a long period of time in the Arctic, and that's what life is all about up there. It represents life for us. So thank you very kindly for this invitation. And, of course, to President Barry Mills and the Board of Governors also, who did nominate me to receive this honorary doctorate, which I am very, very thrilled about. It makes it very special for me. This is my first American one. And in light of the work that you're going to hear about, you will see just why it is so very special for me. So thank you very kindly for all of that. And to Tina, of course, who I don't know if she's come back in the room, but she has been instrumental in getting me down here and also planning out the way in which I could have my friends come here as well, Anne and Michael, who are here. from Chatham, and Anne and I worked together on a education file, a review actually of our education system in my region of Nunavik some years ago, and Anne was instrumental in that work. So I'm absolutely thrilled that she's going to be here to share these moments with me. So here again, and in the background, I always like to bring the ice scapes, the landscapes, and the human faces. And for those of you who have not come to the Arctic before, I think you will want to once you've seen all these slides, because it is a very misunderstood place. It's a majestic place. It's a wonderful place up there. And people tend to see it only in terms of cold. But it's more than weather, and it's lovely. So it is an exciting time as students as well here head off into your own life's journey. And I want to share some reflections on the connections that we have been able to build in the Arctic to shift the paradigm on global thinking about sustainability and humanity's place in our environment. And I want to focus, of course, on the efforts that we have made in the Arctic on the climate consciousness here in your own country as well. And many of you know that the Arctic is going through monumental changes. We have been going through historic environmental and social change. And for decades, of course, we have been witnessing and very much subjected to the most dramatic effects of globalization. In one lifetime, I have to tell you that I, you know, traveled only by dog team the first 10 years of my life. And today, you know, fly jumbo jets to various places around the world in these large global processes and forums. Just to give you a snapshot picture of how quickly things have changed in our world, coming from that very traditional way of life to the modern world, where most societies have taken perhaps 350 years to adjust and to adapt to the situation. For us, it's one lifetime. So you can appreciate what that has come to bring in itself in terms of the tumultuous change. So for those of you who aren't aware of the first challenges that we really started to face back in the 80s when persistent organic pollutants, which are toxins and heavy metals and other contaminants carried by the wind and the ocean currents, ended up in the Arctic sink, in the Arctic, and they came up through the grasshopper effect, what we call depositing in the Arctic, and then making their home there. And as a result of making their home there, our marine mammals, of course, then were poisoned by these toxins, and ultimately our own bodies as Inuit, who are avid eaters of marine mammals, and the nursing milk of our mothers in very high levels. We became the net recipients of these toxins. And so for us, it was not just an issue of environment, it became an issue of health first and foremost. And so I hit the ground running then as a mother and grandmother when all of these things were starting to happen, and I was just getting into the world of politics at that time as ICC Canada President, Inuit Circumpolar Council Canada President. And in the meantime, the CFCs had been weakening the protective ozone layer around the world, but particularly above in the Arctic, leaving us, of course, with much stronger UV radiation from the sun. And now, as you know, most recently, dramatic climate change caused by greenhouse gas emissions has left virtually no feature of our landscape and icescape and our way of life untouched. And that now certainly threatens our hunting culture as we know it. And so these last decades, however, have seen more than just the dramatic environmental changes. They have also witnessed a remarkable awakening of a global environmental consciousness, a realization that we are all connected by a common atmosphere and by our common oceans. And I think people around the world and our planet have certainly begun to see that the Inuit hunter falling through the melting ice in a world that might seem so far removed from your lives here in Maine is connected to the cars we drive, the policies we create, and the disposable world that we have become. So as this consciousness emerged, we so too have the new global partnerships to address these problems. And global environmental challenges have been very successful when parties come together in partnership to acknowledge the connections between far-off sources of pollution and the local impacts on health and environment. And for instance, even as we struggled enormously with the assault of UV radiation, we were able to inject Inuit traditional knowledge and its consequences to all of what was happening in our world. We were able to influence what we call the Montreal Protocol, which has already begun to mend our ozone. So we know that the global community can come together to do the right thing. And more recently, in the late 1990s, early 2000, I was also honored to be a spokesperson for that coalition that we created with Northern Aboriginal peoples in Canada and beyond. And we were at the forefront of the advocacy for the Stockholm Convention that addressed these transboundary contaminants. And again, in that process, we were able to share our knowledge and combine that with the best of science that was there, always in partnership. And together, we showed the world a human face of a devastating problem. Don't forget, sometimes when we're out there in the world negotiating these global treaties, you never really get a sense that there's a human issue at play here, and you certainly don't feel the heartbeat of any of these sessions when you go out there. So we were able to bring that human face in a very urgent way and allowed people to see that indeed the actions from afar really do have negative ramifications to a way of life of a people. And so we built unlikely allies. And I say unlikely because it's always hard to build strong allies between Indigenous peoples or NGOs and government. And so we were able to build those partnerships with government, with industry, in fact, which is highly unlikely, but we were able to do that in that process. And we met with leaders from all walks of life in foreign governments. And of course, we worked very hard with our own governments at all levels. And we certainly actively engaged in the international negotiations as well. Not only were we lobbying in between all of this work in the hallways, but we certainly were very active and oftentimes would take a hold of the drafting pen if we could. And we were very pushy about some of these things of how to change the clauses and the language on some of this work that we did with, in particularly, the Stockholm Convention. And so, of course, we were putting the human face on the of the issue front and center and using our deep knowledge, our familiarity with the problem from a unique voice and a very unique vantage point. We helped the world, and we led the world, in fact, towards a successful resolution in those negotiations. In other words, together, I think we were able to move the world to action. Now, as we know, we are facing much more of a monumental, huge problem, a greater problem, which is even harder to reverse. And so we are aware, and I'm sure you have seen and heard over and over, that the ice is melting faster than anywhere else. And because nowhere else in the world does the ice and snow represent transportation and mobility as it does for us in the Arctic, when it starts to become precarious, it immediately becomes an issue of safety and security. And the latest reports are very stark in the Arctic. And virtually every one of our communities across the Arctic, whether that's in Greenland, whether that's in Alaska, whether that's in Russia or in Canada, which is where we Inuit live, by the way. We're 155,000 Inuit that sit at the top of the world. We used to be many more, but disease and other things just devastated our populations. So every community is now faced with extreme coastal erosion, with melting permafrost, and rapid destructive runoff that threatens to erode away whole towns, especially if you look at and Google Shishmaref and Kevalina in Alaska, you will see they are falling into the sea already. And now there are plans, of course, for it to be relocated. And already we ourselves in Nunavut last summer, one of our communities was cut in half as a result of the fast melt runoff, and it cut right down to the bedrock, and Bannitoq was separated in two. And the bridge gave out. And so we have these kinds of situations that are very real. And despite, you know, I don't know what your weather was like this year, but certainly for us in the Arctic, the last 2 years have been quite cold. And we're saying, good stuff, you know. But we know in reality that there's a big difference between weather patterns that come and go and the larger trends of climate change. And so we know that it wouldn't happen that quickly in terms of the cold coming back. But certainly the ice decline is still very much in rapid decline, the ice. And the glacier melt, long relied upon for drinking water, is also very unpredictable in our communities. And we now have these new species of birds and fish and insects that are coming up into the Arctic that we don't have names for, because they're following the warming trend and they're coming up further and further into the north. And while the size and the type of each change varies across the north, the trends are very, very consistent. And the change is not just coming, it is already it's here in the Arctic. It is already there. And so the impacts of these changes for us are very, very profound. And I don't think people fully understand yet just how devastating that can be and will continue to be if we don't act as quickly as we need to in terms of lowering greenhouse gas emissions. And since climate change will slow the mending of even the mending of the ozone that I said is now on the mend, it will also climate change will not help that to continue to mend as a result of what is happening with the emissions. Then again, it comes down to how badly affected our children and families will be, because we are outdoors people. Even though we may be modern people today who have 9-to-5 jobs, the hunting and fishing and gathering still remain an extremely large part of our livelihoods on a daily basis. And so we are out there all the time hunting and fishing and gathering. And we rely very heavily on the great traditional subsistence food that is so nutritious, much more so than anything that we can possibly buy in the grocery stores. And just to give you an example, a piece of seal meat that is the size of my palm has 4 times the nutritional value as the same piece of beef. And so it's had to be, because we need to be warm when we're out there in the cold. A cup of soup ain't going to do it. It's going to be our country food that warms up our blood while we're out there in 50 below. And so, you know, everything connects. We're all in a place in the world where we need to be, with the exact resources that we need to have to survive. And certainly for us Inuit, we have had all the right things around us to be able to not only survive but thrive. And so already climate change has really affected the migration and quality of our animals, making them harder to hunt and often unsafe to eat. Caribou and seals are less healthy, and our traditional means of even preserving our food are under stress. Our ice cellars are now melting, and these invasive pests now invade the curing meat before it even dries. And hunting and gathering itself has been similarly affected by the shorter periods of safe frozen ice and snow, and that can mean less traveling or even traveling much, much further to get to the same spot where we used to be able to go directly as a result of the unprecarious, you know, the precarious situation of the snow and the conditions of the snow and the ice. And so these unsafe conditions together with less predictable weather mean there are more accidents than ever before. It's not to say that we never had accidents before. That's the nature of being out there in nature that often can happen. But there are more devastating accidents and losses amongst our hunters, and more Inuit sometimes are very careful, much more cautious now to venture out or not venture out at all at certain times or in certain conditions. The predictability used to be so strong. Our elders and hunters and seasoned hunters are, of course, passed down this incredible knowledge and wisdom. And now, because there are so many changes, they put a disclaimer to what it is that they need to teach. And that's really an important piece here. And I will talk about some of that in terms of the power of the process of the hunting culture that is not well understood by many. And are and already, you know, shifting from this highly nutritious food to a southern diet often is now having negative ramifications and impacts on our world in terms of diabetes and heart disease and so on, as we shift away from that traditional diet. Now, I'm going to jump ahead a bit in terms of the work that we did, and perhaps some of you here, I would think, some of the scientists and those who have been involved, and perhaps Susan certainly knows this and others, in 2004, the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment. For those of you that under the Arctic Council, which is the eight-nation council that deals with sustainable development of the Arctic, is one that started the process of some of these really powerful technical assessments. The Arctic Council itself, I must say, can be a difficult council because it's consensus-based and oftentimes gets stalled as a result of that. But its technical ability with technical assessments is remarkable. Stellar work has come out of that work in the Arctic Council. And certainly the Arctic Council impact assessment is one of those. It's a real and also a very outstanding example of partnership between the diverse parties that really have led to the transformative change. And this process of the ACIA was designed to combine our, and we pushed very hard to put traditional knowledge with Western science so that we could more effectively influence policy. And I've always said that the work that I do is trying to change public opinion into public policy. And it's very important, though, to have that stellar, strong science to run with it so it can become, translatable into international policy, as well as national. But in the case that we were working on, it was very international in nature. And so at every stage of the game, we were able to inject in our traditional knowledge, and this process was guided, in fact, and verified the scientific findings as well. And virtually every chapter of that book, as much as we could, resulted from a combination of the two knowledge systems. Very important in this world where oftentimes Indigenous knowledge is very dismissed as being anecdotal and not having the same value as scientific knowledge. Our hunters and elders are very much scientists in their own right. They may not be institutionally recognized, but they certainly know an awful lot. And I know that through this process, many of the scientists were able to learn from our elders and our hunters on how things work in the north, whether it's, the study of our animals or the weather patterns or the ice conditions and so on. And so there was a lot of learning and sharing of our skills and our experiences and our abilities through this process. And I always promote that idea of combining the two knowledge systems. And so our wisdom and guidance were integrated into every facet of the assessment to ensure the process focused not only on the typical geophysical reports of climate change, but its impact on human health, our economies, and our culture. And when it was released in 2004, it provoked a huge response around the world, and media coverage of the Arctic really did spike at that time to a level never before seen. And the Arctic and its people have remained at the forefront of global climate consciousness ever since. And as many of you know, the scientific findings released since the ACIA have only painted even a starker picture since the release of that. Even without the data from the tremendous melt in 2007 that stunned scientists around the world, I think the most alarming projections show a new ice-free seasonal sea at the top of our world by 2012 or 2013, which is just a few years away when you think how quickly things could happen. And also a study from Dr. James Hansen, from the chief climate scientist from Nassau here in the U.S., argues that CO2 has already reached an unsustainable level in our atmosphere and must be reduced as quickly as possible. And it is clear that we must reverse these trends entirely if we are to avoid that rapid and wholesale transformation of the Arctic ecosystem, which is already happening. And so to understand our approach, I will get into, and it's a wonderful start with this picture. He personifies, you know, this right to be cold and how wonderfully joyful he is being cold. This is not a miserable man in the cold. He's a very happy guy. And I just love this picture because I think that's really what it is, what it's all about in terms of loving our world as it is, and that is having it, our right to be cold. And so to understand that, and starting with this incredible picture, I want to begin with the Inuit story. And we are a very adaptable people. You know, people tend to, I think, misunderstand that the fact that we've got so many social problems that have happened in our communities. And again, in the Anchorage news today, I read, you know, how the suicide rates just continue to rise and so on. And it's important for people to understand the context of what these issues and challenges and problems are, so that you don't just start to understand ice problems in isolation of or not connecting to anything else in the Arctic. For me, it's all connected. And people, you know, have said, well, why do you focus so much on the environment when you've got so many social problems in your community? And my response always is, I don't see a disconnect between the two. I see a connectivity with it all, and this is what I'll get into now at the in the crux of my talk. We are very adaptable, and people misunderstand that. We've had to be in order to go with the weather, the seasons, and always be moving in pursuit of the animals and so on over a millennia. So we've had to adapt to so many situations along the way. But we've weathered the storm of modernization reasonably well over the years. As I say, in my lifetime, you know, traveling by dog team the first 10 years of my life, and then now, you know, doing what I do, traveling the world doing that, in a very short period of time, you know, we have come from that world to living this very modern life. And that has happened for us in Canada, and certainly I think in Greenland it's happened for a longer period of time, where the Greenlanders have lived with the Danes for the last 250 years. And for us, I still, you know, remember the stories of my mother when she first saw an airplane coming and terrified of it. You know, it's happened in one lifetime very, very quickly. And so these enormous changes in our communities were often and are often accompanied by a loss of control over our lives from other multiple, what we call historical traumas that have happened in our world. So I bring you back to the time when these historical traumas, which we had in Canada in particular, and perhaps in the other countries, but I speak from Canada right now, forced relocations, where we had whole families forced to go even further way up into the Arctic, where if you think it's cold and dark in Iqaluit, you ain't seen nothing yet when you go even way further up, where we as Inuit, if we had had a choice, would not necessarily have chosen those places because of just how desolate it was even more, and the animals that were not so plentiful at that place. So in the name of sovereignty, these things were happening. Children were uprooted from their families and culture to be deprogrammed and reprogrammed. I had to be sent away at the age of 10 myself, lost my mother tongue, gained it back in my adult life. So, and we had children and family members sent away for medical reasons, never to be heard or seen from again. And only now, some families are finding the grave sites of where their families have been buried as a result of that. We also have an inquiry going on right now in terms of a dog slaughter that happened where about 20,000 dogs were killed in the name of health. But in reality, all of that was taken away from hunters and family members who were in town while their families were still out on the land. It's a long story, but I'm just trying to give you a picture of some of these events that happened that have led to the larger problem of the social issues in our communities. the sexual abuse from those in authority position, the collapse of the sealskin market. If you know, a lot of people have not come to understand that we are not commercial hunters, and we would sell only the byproduct of our hunt. And as a result of the collapse of the entire market, which Brigitte Bardot came over and destroyed almost single-handedly in the 70s, then our hunters went from making, in those years, perhaps $18,000 a year to zero overnight. A culture that was in transition, where there was no other way in which a father, the hunter, could provide for his family, was totally devastating, not just in terms economically, but emotionally, spiritually. And his integrity was completely destroyed. And that was one of the starting points of the dispirited hunter, the man who was so badly affected by all of this. So together, all of these very traumatic events have deeply wounded and dispirited many, translating into this collective pain of families, communities, and nations. And the substance abuse, the health problems, and the most distressing, the loss of so many of our young people, and particularly our boys between the ages of 16 and 24, taking their lives at a rate higher than anywhere else in North America. That has been one of the saddest effects of this tumultuous change and these generational historical traumas. But through it all, we've always had our culture. We had our way of life. We had our hunting culture. We had the predictability of our environment. We had the climate and the wisdom that carried us through all of this turmoil. And it helped us to adapt because we had that. However, things are very different today. They are not predictable as they used to be. And because we remain a hunting people, very reliant on the well-being of the environment and the climate, and we then are affected by it in more ways than one. So the hunting culture is not just the technical aspect of going out and harvesting our animals and sharing and so on and so forth. Those technical skills are extremely important, of course, in an environment where we come from, where things can happen and change very quickly. But what the process of the hunting culture teaches, and we all, by the way, were hunters, gatherers, and fishers at one time, and farming is somewhat similar to some of the skills that I'm going to talk about, which are very important. And you bear with me because it all connects to the environment, climate, sustainability, and our connectivity as a whole. The process of the hunt is so important. It teaches our young people to be patient. It teaches the character skills. When you're waiting for the weather to clear, when you're waiting for the animals to show, when you're waiting for the snow to fall, the ice to form, all of those things, you are, just by the nature of nature, you are being taught how to be patient. You are taught how to be bold and courageous under certain circumstances in taking survival-based risks. And that's important to do in the developing years of young people. And you are taught how to deal with pressure, how to be bold under pressure, how to withstand stress. You are taught to be reflective in all that you do around you. In other words, not to be impulsive. Because if you're impulsive out in the land, it's not forgiving. You take an action, an impulsive act, and you perish, or you put your family and loved ones in jeopardy. And ultimately, because when we found what we have found in our study of our young people taking their lives is that one of the skills that has not been developed or has been lost is impulsivity, because taking one's life is very impulsive. There is not a lot of reflection. You're too much over-identified with your thoughts and your problems that you don't reflect before taking such drastic measures to end your life. And so They learn on the land to control their impulses and to withstand that kind of stressful situation. And ultimately, it is to have sound judgment and wisdom. And it is not only for the land that these skills are required. They are very transferable to the modern world. And in fact, in a world where we are transitioning so quickly, they are much more of a requirement to survive. So that our young people who are learning these skills on the land in times of great stress in the modern world, which has come to our doorstep so very quickly, are able to have this integrated within themselves. That perhaps it is not the right thing to do to impulsively become self-destructive or take my life or become violent. There's so much potent ways in which the cultural way can be transferred to the modern world. And these are the things that are so important for people to understand, that when we deal with these issues, there is that balance that we're trying to find. We're not trying to just step back and be hunting, fishing, gathering people on, 7 days a week. And in fact, the young people who have their foot in our strong culture learning those skills are making it in the new world, in the modern world. And because one way of life is not and should not be at a cost to the other. And so the fact, as I say, because culture is not trivial, it's not window dressing, and people tend to think culture, and indigenous culture, only in terms of song and legends and folklore, although those are very, very important part of keeping your spirit alive, as we all are in the world, love song and dance and art. And there's not enough of that, I think, in my opinion, in the world to be accepted as a way to keep our spirits going. But culture also very much carries the values, the principles, and the traditions and the wisdom to be able to really balance the two worlds, the two lives. So that's why, and I go back now, to, for us, climate change is an issue of our right and ability to exist as an indigenous people. And it is precisely that right that is being challenged and minimized by the unpredictability of our climate. So as traveling and hunting on the land becomes more dangerous, then there are fewer people that lead that traditional way of life. And that means there is less being passed down in terms of that powerful wisdom that is so important for our young people to not only survive, but thrive as a hunting culture, but transfer those skills into whatever it is they wish to do. I had a question asked to me in Washington, D.C., a couple of years ago, asking, why don't you people just assimilate and become engineers and professionals? And again, my answer was, it's not about either or. That's not the point here. I would want my 12-year-old grandson, whom you will meet at the end, I think you've already seen him, on who's learning how to be, hunt. But I would want him to have that connection to hunting only because it gives him that foundation. You can get that, of course, through connecting to nature in different ways. I'm not suggesting we all go out and become hunters now. The point is, are you connected to the cycles of nature? Are you connected to yourself in terms of how that is connected to the larger cycles of life and circle of life? And so I would want him to be what he wants to be, as long as he understands that he understands what's happening with our planet, the healthiness of that, what he's hunting, and what, you know, the changes that are happening in his world, his physical world. He understands that, so he can make judgments in how he lives and how he works in his daily life. And that's the importance, you see. So hikers and canoeists and fishers who are in the audience will relate to that, to become more connected to knowing what is happening. Because although, you know, my grandson, I think he wants to be a hockey player, but, I'd want him to be a good hunting hockey player. You know, there is no cost to the other. Do you know what I mean? So as well, The decline, of course, and I mentioned earlier, is causing a lot of expensive, much more of an expense for families because we are having to buy more store-bought food. And I think when we start to lose that way of life, it becomes the first step towards the loss of our language, our arts, and our culture. And that is the very way of life for us as Indigenous people. And I think if we protect the environment and climate of the Arctic, keep our hunting culture alive, and stay connected to the rhythms and cycles of nature, we will prevail a lot stronger. There is no doubt about that. And so seeing all of these impacts that were happening to our health, to our culture, to our economy, and to our society as a whole, we were very determined to act. And after 2 years of preparation with legal teams, in particularly from America, actually, we launched in 2005, submitted a climate change related petition to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights on behalf of myself and Inuit in Alaska and Canada. And in order to prepare that petition, it's not just signatures, it was a legal document, that we engaged a team that spanned across North America with our own counsel and advisors in the North, along with legal scholar Professor James Anaya, who is an expert on Indigenous human rights from the Law School of the University of Arizona. And we also had Don Goldberg and Martin Wagner from Earth Justice, and at the time, Don was with CL in Washington, D.C., Center for International Environmental Law. And from this diverse partnership, we sought a declaration that the destruction of the Arctic environment and the culture and economy of our people, Inuit, as a result of the virtually unrestricted emissions of greenhouse gases by the United States, which is a source of 25% worldwide, was indeed violating our human rights guaranteed by the 1948 American Declaration on the Rights and Duties of Man, which of course includes the rights to subsistence, our right to traditional lands, our right to health, to culture and environment. It was on our part a real political strategy. We had already been going through some enormous challenges in terms of how do we get this remarkable country of the United States on side? How do we get them to start to become team players with everybody else that seemed to be eager to do the right thing? And because we knew that through our entire process, even through the POPs work, it was very difficult, but we managed at that time to be successful. But we knew that climate change was going to be tough. It was going to be tougher even now to get the world on side, and in particularly, we wanted the United States to come back and lead. So the purpose of the petition, some people might have interpreted as, how confrontational is that, or how extreme for you to target the United States? Why not Canada? Why not other countries that were not doing any much better? But, you know, targeting Canada as well, which has been very poor in their action as well due to the oil sands, would have let the U.S. off the hook at the time. And so there was a lot of political strategy in place there. And the purpose of this petition was to educate and to encourage the government of the United States to join the community of nations in a global campaign to really address this issue of climate change. And the energy behind it, because, and I know this because I led this campaign, was not aggressive or confrontational. We were reaching out, not striking out. And in a real sense, I have always said this around the world and in the United States, our petition was a gift. It was a gift. It was a gift from our elders and our hunters to the world. It was, in fact, an act of generosity from an ancient culture deeply tied, still tied, to the natural environment and still in tune with its wisdom, to an urban, industrial, and modern culture that had largely lost its sense of place and position in the natural world. In fact, and I keep saying, it was the most caring act that I have ever brought forward in the protection of my cultural heritage, and the most caring act I have ever brought forward in the protection of the future of my 12-year-old grandson, who is now learning to hunt and respect all that is around him as he continues to play hockey. So the petition was our way of reaching out to all of you in the United States and of turning that public opinion into public policy. And since then, that time, even though the commissioners of the Inter-American Commission on Climate Change, for their own reasons, were not willing to take the bold step to look at our petition in depth and take action on it, they nevertheless agreed for us and my legal team to come down and testify. Not on our petition necessarily, not only on the Arctic necessarily, but the legal implications or the real connection they wanted to understand better between climate change and human rights. And we did. I went down with my legal team and we testified at its first hearing on the links between climate change and human rights. And as I said, even though they chose not to go forward with the petition, I do believe that the power of our attempt, because don't forget, there's young people who are just getting into life here, into your workforce and finishing up. Oftentimes, it isn't just about taking action that you think, oh, maybe it's not going to work. Maybe I shouldn't because it's not going to work anyway. But you know, there is such power in the attempt. And don't ever underestimate that power in the attempt of what it is that you believe in. When, even though the odds were so stacked up against me and my fellow Inuit who chose to go this route, I can guarantee you this was the most right thing I have ever felt in my life to do, was to make that connection between climate change and human rights. And because the energy behind what I did was not aggressive or angry or confrontational, I was reaching out to the citizens of America. And you can pretty much see, and I don't say this statement from an ego standpoint of view of trying to take too much credit for this, but I must say to you that we started to see the influence that putting the human face and the human rights angle started to shift the thinking in a country like yours that already was starting to move in that direction in the first place. And so people started to listen more, in the U.S. in particularly, and started to demand more change in your own country. And I do believe that we did help to influence that real shift of climate consciousness in that way. I had so many supportive emails and calls from America saying, what are we doing? What can we do to help? I had more speaking engagement invitations from the United States of America after we launched that petition than I did anywhere else in the world. Why? The citizens that were ahead of their own government wanted to do the right thing. And now change has finally come to America. And I expect an enormous change both at home and abroad as you retake that leadership on the world stage. And we're in a good place, I believe. But several years ago, in 2004, I spoke before, and these are not partisan because I'm not into partisan politics here, but I just to let you know, just how things did go in our activism, or in my, at the time I was elected to represent our people. I'm no longer since almost 3 years, and I've remained passionately engaged with this work because for me it's not about the positions I held. This is a life's work. This is a passion, and it's important, and I do it for the little guy, which I think you have already, may have, I'm not paying attention to the pictures here. But in 2004, I testified at Senator John McCain's Committee on Science, Commerce, and Transportation, back when he was virtually alone in his party in his willingness to address this issue. He and Hillary Clinton, in fact, both of them would go up to the Arctic in Alaska, in fact, and were part of the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, just trying themselves where they stand in, you know, as policymakers to understand better. So they went to the Alaska a couple of times, and in fact we're all on the ACIA DVD together. Not together, but in the same DVD. And so I went down to testify at John McCain's Senate committee. I think I believe you have Senator Snow is from here, is she not? She was there along with Senator Lieberman. And the three senators were hearing our piece. And I'm going to quote what I said at the time. And this is a quote. I grew up in a small community of Kudjuak in Ungava Bay in northern Quebec and traveled by dog team for the first 10 years of my life. Americans played a very important role in the history of my community. During the Second World War, many Inuit were starving, caught in a transition between a nomadic way of life and moving into a settled community. At that time, when most Inuit thought they had been totally forgotten by our own governments, that is, the Americans arrived to build airstrips, bringing with them jobs for the men and supplies and food for the community. They came through for us during those challenging times in a very big way. Until her death 2 years ago, don't forget this is 2004, my mother always stated, we would not have pulled through if it were not for the arrival of the Americans. And I continued and I said, the Inuit once again need your help in these challenging times. The ACIA projects the end of Inuit as a hunting culture that has sustained us for millennia. And I said, come back to help us. I have already said that what is happening in the Arctic is a snapshot of the future of the planet, and that indeed we are all connected. Climate change is a matter of survival of humanity as a whole. It is the most pressing global issue we face today. Protect the Arctic, and we will save the planet. That's an excerpt of the longer piece that I did. And to hear now, when I come in that period of time, and now especially to hear, we're back. I hear that now where I go in America. We're back. And that is so hopeful for us who are in the Arctic, who oftentimes, even with our own governments, are still grappling with this issue of them not being able to take full action. And I think Obama's plans are now ahead of our own Canadian government's plans. And so we continue to plug away at our own government too. So today, I continue to believe, I do, that America will lead our world to a climate solution. I have much hope for that. And I believe the rest of the world has been listening as well and getting ready for that leadership, for your leadership. The United Nations Human Rights Council has now recognized climate change as a human rights issue for all Indigenous peoples. They passed a resolution last April. And more recently, the United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights has carefully detailed the multitude of ways that climate change is already interfering with human rights around the world. And most importantly, this office argues that we address climate change over the coming decades, we have to use the human rights approach to empower individuals and communities and give all of those affected active participation in the decision-making that affects their lives. And unfortunately, the ever greater urgency that the newest science requires has not been met by action on the global level, which only deepens the need for all the parties to adopt this rights-based approach to a solution. And I think the lesson here for all of us is that while the language of economics and technology may call for more delay as a result of what's happening, reframing the debate, I think, in terms of the connections between the fundamental human rights and environmental change refocuses the debate on humanity, not just efficiency. And this can spur, I think, decision makers to action in a way that no dry technical report can, if we keep it human at the human level. And I think our nations and our communities can lead by making the use, again, of those who are most negatively impacted, the Indigenous peoples, the vulnerable peoples of the world, the poor, the human faces, as we move into post-Kyoto and we head to Copenhagen in December for the COP meeting there. And this treaty perhaps now offers that best last chance for us to come together to reduce and eliminate greenhouse gases before the changes spiral beyond our control, which many are already. And I think in this effort, vulnerable people and cultures must be more than simply window dressing for the interests that too often control our development decisions and international negotiating positions. And I think rather informing these decisions and positions with the wisdom of northern cultures must be part of a broad-based, principled rethinking on our global approach. And I want to stress here, I'm not about stopping or halting all economic development, but rather we need to retake real control over that development by insisting that every opportunity and program by systematically be analyzed against its impact on our world, meaning the greenhouse gases it will emit, the unsustainable cycles it will feed, and the lasting impact it will make on our delicate landscape and health of our people. In other words, we have to mainstream climate change, both in mitigation and adaptation, into our everyday planning processes. And whenever we make these development decisions, we have to consider all the implications for what we are doing, and not only for ourselves, but always for the future generations and for those whom we are connected to around the world. There's no doubt about that, by our common sea and air. And as we do that, we ask those making similar decisions to do the same for us. So the balance then is really an understanding. Again, I'm very big on this, the interconnection with all of humanity, and working to ensure that all of humanity understands that connection with us. And I hope that these lessons that I have just spoken about in our work in the past have given you some insights into what it is that we're faced with in the Arctic, that when you think of ice and snow, you have to think beyond that. And it's the sustainability of an entire way of life of people that's so important for us to maintain, so that our kids are going to start to embrace life and be able to balance the two worlds, because there is no way of going back to just that. And that's not what we're talking about. It is not at a cost to the other, as I said earlier. So I hope that some of these insights have helped you, so that you can start to also build partnerships where they may be towards transformative change in your own lives as well. And for the younger people who are embarking on your life journeys, I urge you never to accept limitations on what it is that you feel you need to do, what is important to you, whether they be technological that you're working on, whether it's scientific. I introduce you and end with my grandson, who is the reason why I do what I do, and he is very precious. And so whatever it is that you need to do, we can achieve together as a shared humanity. And never underestimate that power that connects us all, because it's when we think that we're separate from one another that that's the problems that we have. It is that disconnect between ourselves and our environment and ourselves as neighbors and as humanity is the reason why we're debating this issue of climate change in the first place. So if we could start to reconnect and not see ourselves as so separate, this will be the solution, I believe, that will bring the world together to do the right thing. So thank you, Bodina, again, to be inviting me here at this beautiful little place. I got in very late last night, have not seen the sights around. I really look forward to that. And thank you for being patient and listening to what I have to say, the voice from the Arctic today. Nakomik Maleli.
You've been listening to environmental activist Sheila Watt-Cloutier on Speaking in Maine. If you missed part of the program or would like to hear it again, it will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Look under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen for Audio On Demand, where you'll find a listing of available programs, including this, and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. A service made possible by member support. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Gordon Fellis.